Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, Emerging Treatments for Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma. It's a very important program, and we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 642 people on the call, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, and you come from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Dominican Republic, Germany, Malaysia, and Syria. So you really are from all over the world, and it's a really credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I want to turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you to utilize. Now, there is also an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics that you would like us to offer in the future? And because we are planning all of our current programs coming up, we very much appreciate your recommendations for topics and suggestions. They're incredibly important to us, so we keep the programs most relevant to your particular needs. Now, today's program was made possible by Friends of Cancer Care and an educational grant from Biogen IDEC. And we really want to thank them for supporting this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today. I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is Director of Lymphoid Development and Malignancy Program at the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center. He's Chief Lymphoma Service, College of Physicians and Surgeons, Columbia University. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address an overview of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and symptom and pain management. Dr. O'Connor.
Hi, thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you for the opportunity to chat with everybody today, and thank you especially for providing this important educational opportunity for patients with lymphoma. What Carolyn has asked me to do today over the next 13 minutes is to talk briefly about an overview of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, to discuss in very general terms some of the current standards of care, to discuss some new treatment approaches that are emerging, and to discuss a little bit about symptom and pain management. As all of you, I am sure, appreciate, each one of those topics is probably an hour each, but I will touch on them in general terms. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, as you are all aware by now, is a pretty diverse set of diseases. In the United States, each year there are about 64,000-65,000 cases per year of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The classification of these diseases has really matured a lot over the last century, and we now use lots of very sophisticated biological tools to try to discriminate one form of lymphoma from the other. All non-Hodgkin's lymphomas are basically a malignancy of white blood cells, and white blood cells come in a whole variety of different flavors. They may be neutrophils, eosinophils, basophils, lymphocytes, and lymphomas, in fact, are malignancies of these lymphocytes. Lymphocytes typically come in two big flavors, but three general flavors, B lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, and something called NK lymphocytes. And the fundamental role of all of these cells is to play a role in your immune system to fight off infection, be it from bacteria, fungi, or even to play a role in the rejection of transplanted tissue from other individuals. The most common of the lymphocytes that circulate in the blood are actually B lymphocytes, and it makes sense then that the most common forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are B-cell lymphomas. they account for about 85% of all cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. T-cell lymphomas are comparatively more rare. They account for about 10 to 15% of all cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in the United States, maybe only account for about 5 or 6,000 cases per year of lymphoma. And to a far more rare extent, the NK cell lymphomas, which I probably won't even talk about. In fact, when you look at the most common forms of lymphoma, the two most common are diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it's an aggressive form of lymphoma, and follicular lymphoma, which is a more indolent form. And so for all practical purposes, rather than thinking about all 60 different kinds of lymphoma, one way that most lymphoma doctors approach the disease is to make two big pots. We break them up into aggressive diseases, i.e., those diseases that are fast-growing and oftentimes warrant some sort of therapy at the time of diagnosis, versus indolent lymphomas, which are typically more chronic diseases. They can be managed. Sometimes they don't even get treated. Doctors may choose to watch them for some period of time as long as the disease isn't bothering you. And we have lots of effective therapies for both the aggressive lymphomas and the indolent lymphomas. And many of these therapies can involve chemotherapy, biologic therapy like rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody, and more often than not, combinations of these two forms of therapy, biologic therapies like rituximab with systemic chemotherapy like CHOP-based therapy. Talking about the current standards of care is a bit of a challenge because with 60 or so different kinds of lymphoma, we are increasingly more aware that this is not one therapy fits all. Increasingly, we are becoming more sophisticated about the selection of the treatment we use for different subtypes of cancer. Now, it would be naive for me to say that we use one therapy for all of these different cancers, and it would also be naive of me to say that the data firmly support use of certain therapies in specific subtypes. CHOP-based chemotherapy, or R-CHOP-based chemotherapy, is a fairly common standard combination chemotherapy that's been with us for a good 30 years or so. And it's the standard therapy used for diseases like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and sometimes T-cell lymphomas. The B-cell lymphomas, like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, are typically very, very responsive to R-CHOP-based chemotherapies. Other therapies that can be used oftentimes vary as a function of the disease being treated. So in diseases like mantle cell lymphoma, for example, there's a lot of controversy amongst doctors who specialize in treating those diseases as to whether they should use CHOP chemotherapy up front or hyper-CVAD or EPOC or other forms of combination therapy. And oftentimes what patients discover is that there are strong institutional bias towards the selection of those therapies, and oftentimes investigators who are very vested in one of these approaches may be studying it more intensively and as a result may use it more commonly. Diseases like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma have a fairly standard paradigm that most doctors who treat cancer around the United States are familiar with. That paradigm is R-CHOP-based chemotherapy, and should patients need it, there are subsequent second-line chemotherapies that are still very effective, like ICE-based chemotherapy or DHAP, followed by a stem cell transplant. Diseases like follicular lymphoma have a little bit more controversy around them. Many of those patients may be watched for some period of time. Depending upon the risk of the disease, some may receive simple single-agent Rituxan. Others, again, depending upon the extent of disease they have and the risk, may receive systemic chemotherapy. So it's a challenging topic to talk about in 13 minutes, but given the diversity of different subtypes of lymphoma, we are increasingly getting a little bit more savvy about how to apply certain therapies to certain diseases. The T-cell lymphomas, which are comparatively more uncommon, represent a bit of a challenge. And these are diseases where, at the moment, there seem to be a lot of new drugs in development that have activity in T-cell lymphoma. And it's interesting that when you actually look at guidelines for the management of these diseases, and in fact one set of guidelines, the NCCN, make recommendations in terms of treatment paradigms for many forms of cancer, one of their first recommendations for the upfront treatment of T-cell lymphoma is in fact a clinical trial. And that actually reflects our lack of understanding about the optimal way to treat patients with T-cell lymphoma. But there are a host of different therapies that can be used effectively to put patients into remission with a goal to try to improve our ability to manage these diseases long term. Oftentimes, other standards of care that can be integrated into the treatment paradigms for patients with lymphoma include various forms of transplantation. And transplants come in a host of different flavors. The most commonly employed, in fact, are what are referred to as autologous stem cell transplants. These transplants are predicated on the idea that if a little chemotherapy is good, a lot has to be better. And in those transplant settings, what happens is patients get relatively higher doses of chemotherapy. After we collect progenitor stem cells from your bone marrow, which we freeze away, then after the high-dose chemotherapy, these stem cells are infused to sort of reconstitute or reestablish normal bone marrow function. And autologous stem cell transplants have been incredibly valuable in helping patients with relapsed forms of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and Hodgkin's disease and some forms of mantle cell lymphoma. But in some cases, when we don't use, it's not appropriate to use the patient's own stem cells, we can use an alternative form of transplant known as allogeneic stem cell transplant. And in these forms of transplants, we use stem cells collected from either a sibling or someone else in the country that happens to be an appropriate tissue match for you. And these transplants are really not predicated on the idea of using more chemotherapy. They're predicated on trying to exploit the immune system of those donated stem cells that might grow in your body and trying to exploit the ability of the donor immune system to help fight your form of lymphoma. And allogeneic stem cell transplants really seem to be emerging as valuable forms of therapy for patients with mantle cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma and possibly patients with T-cell lymphoma. Right now, it happens to be an incredibly exciting time in the treatment of lymphoma because the number of new drugs being developed is simply difficult to keep up with. It's almost a full-time job. And we've now, over the last 30 years, spent a lot of time and a lot of money on trying to understand the biological differences between a malignant cell and a normal cell, and in fact, also the genetic differences between various subtypes of lymphoma. This information has now given way to lots of drugs that are not going to carry with them the same kind of nonspecific cytotoxicity that the conventional chemotherapies we use today have. Many of these drugs are being targeted to discrete specific lesions in the tumor cell, targeting these cancer cells at their very roots. And I'll just discuss some of these examples some examples of these new drugs to establish the point. There are new drugs today that are able to help lower the threshold required to induce lymphoma cells to die. As you might imagine, every cancer cell has two fundamental defects. They grow when they shouldn't, and they don't die when they're supposed to. So a lot of the drugs that we've used historically to treat these diseases have really been oriented towards stopping tumor cells from growing and dividing. But we now have a whole new era of new drugs that really help teach tumor cells how to die. And they do that by lowering the threshold required to allow those cells to die, sometimes in the face of conventional chemotherapy, sometimes in the face of just the drug itself. So there are a host of these new agents. ABT-263 is one you may be reading about, AT-101, and a molecule that's been around for a little while known as Obler-Meyerson or BCL-2 antisense. And these drugs seem to have marked activity in various patients with lymphoma. Another class of drugs you may hear a lot about that are coming along are the histone deacetylase inhibitors. And this could also take Dr. Vose and I an hour to talk about. But these drugs operate in a very complicated way. But the simple explanation is that they seem to be able to allow information in your DNA to be expressed or to be turned off. And so they modulate the expression of genes inside tumor cells. And so the short explanation for how these compounds work is by inducing the activation of certain genes that will promote cell death. And so the histone deacetylase inhibitors have been recently approved for the treatment of some forms of T-cell lymphoma, including cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. There are now many, many HDAC inhibitors in development, and for reasons that are not entirely clear, they seem to be very promising drugs for the treatment of T-cell lymphomas, and many of these are now sitting before the U.S. FDA for approval in other indications for the treatment of blood cancers. The third category I'll mention will be proteasome inhibitors, and these are another very interesting class of drugs that seem to affect the turnover or accumulation of protein inside the cell. One of these drugs is called bortezomib. It's a drug that was first approved for the treatment of multiple myeloma and eventually then was found to have very interesting activity in the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma and, in fact, became the first drug ever approved for the treatment of that disease. So in addition to these small molecules, we also have a lot of interesting biologics. And on the heels of the success of rituximab, there are now a whole diversity of new monoclonal antibodies targeting these discrete proteins on the surfaces of lymphocytes and lymphoma cells. These drugs, as many of you may be aware, are very, very effective. They're very effective as single agents. They complement chemotherapy, and they're relatively well tolerated compared to conventional chemotherapy. There are many new paradigms in development, much the same way we combined molecules like cyclophosphamide and doxorubicin and vincristine and prednisone to create CHOP. Physicians are now trying to better understand the merits of combining different kinds of antibodies to create combinations of antibodies that will target lymphomas in a less toxic, more efficacious way, creating a potentially entirely new platform for treating these diseases in a more biological and hopefully less toxic way. Many of you are familiar with radioimmunotherapy, and we now have a number of exciting drugs that are also very, very effective in the treatment of lymphoma. And what these molecules are is they take a molecule like Rituxan, a monoclonal antibody that targets a protein on the surface of B cells called CD20, and they arm or hook up a radioisotope like iodine or yttrium to that monoclonal antibody. And in this way, the analogy that's been used to describe it is liquid radiation. Then you just infuse these radioimmunotherapy-type drugs into the vein. They circulate in the body, and then they selectively target and allow for a concentration of radiation right on the tumor. So this way you don't get that nonspecific radiation of other important normal vital organs, and it allows for a concentrated exposure of radiation to the tumor site. These drugs have proven to be very effective in a host of different lymphomas, including follicular lymphoma as well as transformed lymphomas. And maybe the holy grail of all of cancer research is to try to find vaccines, ways to try to exploit your own immune system's ability to fight lymphoma. These are in development in a variety of cancers. In prostate cancer, there are some examples. And there have been some trials of vaccines in lymphoma, and it's very early in investigation, but there are some recent intriguing data to suggest that they may have some ability in terms of stimulating one's own immune system to try to target the lymphoma, but they're still a long way from being commercially available. One of the other challenges oncologists have to face is not just how to manage the side effects of the chemotherapy, but also to figure out ways to manage side effects of the disease. And patients who are oftentimes undergoing chemotherapy will incur a number of different toxicities, including fatigue, neuropathy. Rarely do lymphoma patients experience pain unless they have lymphoma growing in a sensitive part of the body. And we are developing, though I'd have to say not at a pace that's incredibly impressive, we are developing new treatments for the symptoms related to chemotherapy, like neuropathy. Neuropathy is a common side effect of many new drugs like bortezomib, as well as many old drugs like vincristine and vinblastin. It's a typically difficult symptom to manage, but there are drugs out there like Lyrica that are very helpful in managing neuropathy. Fatigue is one of those almost inevitable side effects that patients who are on chemotherapy long enough will experience. Sometimes it's attributable to easily manageable things like anemia. Sometimes it's attributed to other multifactorial reasons that are a little bit harder to solve, but it represents a side effect that bothers a lot of patients in terms of their ability to engage in all those activities of daily living that they'd like to engage. But a close relationship with your physician and the nurses that work with your physician will really help you identify good strategies to manage these diseases. And maybe the most important aspect of managing symptoms related to treatment or cancer itself is by having a good open channel of communication with not just the doctor, but the physicians, nurses, and support staff.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, for an excellent presentation, wonderful overview, and just really giving lots of information. I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Vose, and she is a Newman M. and Mildred E. Harris Professor, Chief Section of Hematology Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Vose is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research influences treatment options, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Vose?
Thank you, Carolyn. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with everyone today, and also want to thank you for providing this for patients. It's really a great opportunity. So first I'm going to talk about the role of clinical trials for patients with lymphoma or cancer in general. And clinical trials are really an opportunity for patients and for families and also healthcare providers to test new therapies, different supportive care agents, or evaluate certain aspects of one's care, such as the quality of life of patients during cancer therapy. And this is really especially important in cancer care, as unfortunately some of our medications don't work in every patient, and we do need to look for different opportunities for new advancements, as Dr. O'Connor spoke with you about. So just in the way of kind of what happens, how do we develop these new therapies and how do they get to patients? Typically, a lot of these newer therapies are looked at in particularly laboratory-based research in cancer centers throughout the United States, usually at university cancer centers and also in pharmaceutical companies. And they look to be promising based upon some early laboratory research models. If they do appear to be promising, then typically they're taken to animal research and looked at as far as side effects for the animals before being taken onto human research. And then they go through a series of different types of studies before they are presented to the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, for potential approval, and then they are generally available. So this whole process, as far as taking a medication or drug or agent from the time it's discovered in a test tube in a laboratory until it's available for patients, typically takes many years, and an average time in the U.S. would probably be 7 to 15 years before all of the appropriate studies are done. There's a number of different types of studies that are performed. I just want to go over those different nomenclatures, as sometimes it's a bit confusing. Phase 1 clinical trials are clinical trials where we're looking for the side effects or toxicities of some of the medications. These are types of studies that are generally very broad with respect to the types of patients that are included in that trial. And the idea is hopefully to try to get some activity against the patient's cancer, but really the aim of the trial is also to look at the side effects for the medication. This is the first type of trial that goes into patients. The next, if it looks somewhat promising in phase 1 and doesn't have a lot of excess side effects, would be phase 2 studies. And those are the types of studies where we're trying to narrow that down a little bit to look at specific types of malignancies and then also to look at the efficacy or how well that works in the different types of cancers. And those are typically also done at large cancer centers for both the phase 1 and phase 2 trials and not so much done in the community cancer centers. If it looks promising based upon phase 2 data, and that's looking at the side effects profile, that it's satisfactory, that it appears to be somewhat promising as far as working against the cancer, then it's taken on to what's called phase 3 trials. Phase 3 trials are very large trials that are generally in one type of cancer. And that's where a patient is randomized. So usually a computer chooses the different types of treatments, not the physician, not the patient. And typically the new therapy is tested against a standard of care therapy. So one common misconception is that placebos are used or non-active agents in this type of treatment. And that's never the case. In cancer clinical trials, the control arm is always the standard of care treatment that's available for the patient in that situation. And that's compared to the newer treatment, which can often be just an add-on to the standard treatment. And that is then taken to the Food and Drug Administration, all this information for potential approval for general population use. There's also an additional type of trial that's done after the FDA approval. That's called a Phase 4 trial, and that's where a larger number of patients are tested with respect to the new drug and in that specific patient population, and those are typically done on a very widespread basis. Now, as I mentioned, this whole entire time that these trials are going on takes a number of years, and during that time, there is very important information that's gathered. Now, a question I often get is, how do we know that this new drug is safe? Well, unfortunately, we don't know 100% that that's true, but there's everything that's done before that as far as laboratory studies and also very intense study by the physicians and also by independent committees to try to make sure that it is safe as possible. Also, the informed consent form that patients sign go over all the potential side effects that are known for that medication. The other thing I think that's important to keep in mind is the clinical trials make these drugs available years before they're otherwise generally available. So if you do participate in a clinical trial, typically you get access to these medications years before they would be made generally available to the public so that you can benefit from that. You're not only benefiting yourself, but you're also hopefully benefiting thousands of future cancer patients who would be able to be treated with those medications. I just want to give you one example of a medication that's very widely used now, and that would be the monoclonal antibodies for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Those years ago were not used, and we didn't have those available. Many of the patients that participated in those early clinical trials, and you can see now that those medications are generally used in almost every type of B-cell lymphoma and how generally applicable that is. So if those patients hadn't chosen to participate in those trials, we wouldn't have that available today for everyone. Where can you find clinical trials? There's a number of different areas. Certainly you should talk to your physician regarding your particular situation to see if that's a possibility. Also, some websites to look at would be important. Clinicaltrials.gov is a website that's through the National Cancer Institute and is very inclusive of all clinical trials throughout the United States. You can also check with your local cancer center or regional large university cancer center. How does research influence your treatment? I think that patients that participate in clinical trials or research opportunities typically are followed up more closely. They have a more thorough evaluation, more close follow-up, and are watched more closely during the treatment and probably after the treatment. They often have a research nurse who's assigned to them, and they have just a select number of patients that they follow. So many times patients get very more personalized attention when they are in a clinical trial. Also, some of these new medications might be quite beneficial with respect to treating the lymphoma. Certainly, we need to be on the lookout for any side effects that are either known or unknown, and the patients are typically, as I mentioned, followed very closely during that. And the research would benefit your treatment in that, again, you're not only helping yourself, but hopefully helping many thousands of patients in the future. Another area I want to talk about today is communication with your healthcare team. This is a very important aspect of your care. I typically recommend that patients bring a family member or friend with them to their appointments, in particular your early appointments where you're trying to gather information. A lot of times patients write down information, also tape information, because sometimes it's hard to listen to everything yourself during an appointment. You're overwhelmed and a lot of information is given. It's also very important to make sure that with each of your appointments, you bring an accurate list of your medications so that it can be in your record, and make sure that every physician that you see has an accurate list of your medications. Medications are something that oftentimes have many side effects and can cause interactions or problems, so you want to make sure that all your physicians and nurses know exactly what medications you're taking, even the over-the-counter medications. Another important aspect of communication is to be sure to write down all of your questions before you see the physician or interact with your healthcare team. I know it's really difficult, and certainly it's important to try to write down things so that you remember them, because in a time of stress, it's difficult to remember all the different issues that you want to discuss, so that's a very important aspect. Also, to make sure that you let the physicians know any supplements or over-the-counter medications you might be taking. some of these can't interfere with chemotherapy, and so we want to make sure that you aren't taking supplements that could potentially cause problems or interactions. There's certainly no reason to be taking some of our treatments, which can have certain side effects, and if you're going to take supplements that are going to counteract that. So we want to be sure to discuss that with your physician or your healthcare team. Also, I think a very important thing I always point out is to make sure to get written information regarding your disease and treatments that you're receiving from a reliable source. And so that means getting it from your healthcare team, from reliable sources such as Lymphoma Research Foundation, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, National Cancer Institute, and not necessarily from any website that you see out there, because some of them do not necessarily have the correct information. So be sure you're getting information from a reliable source. And be sure to have a plan with respect to if there are any problems, who do you contact during the day and after hours or on weekends, because sometimes there are complications or problems that occur, and unfortunately they often do occur out of normal working hours, and you need to know, have an emergency plan who to contact, and your healthcare provider should talk about that. And lastly, I want to touch on quality of life concerns. Certainly this is a huge issue in anyone's life, and the diagnosis, the treatments, concerns of relapse or complications can lead to a major change in the patient and also the family's quality of life. So I want to be sure that you know that you should reach out to family, friends, and healthcare professionals to try to provide support for you. And there are typically a number of different ways to do that. And each individual person needs to be comfortable with what form of support they're getting. Definitely should be open about your concerns and communicate to your physician or other healthcare team members to try to get the support that's necessary. Sometimes support groups are helpful for some people, but there are other patients or families that really don't want to be so open about that, and perhaps more personalized sharing of the information and how healthcare support could be more appropriate for that patient or individual family member. And then also just to talk about general overall health as far as trying to get you through the therapy and to help with the quality of life, I think it's important to remember that good nutrition and exercise management are very helpful just in anyone's attitude and overall improvement of quality of life. And this is particularly true in patients that are going through treatment. So I want to make sure that you keep in mind that this should be an overall help with respect to getting through your treatment. Thank you very much, and I believe we'll be answering questions a little bit later.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Vett. That was a very excellent presentation and just for really such a comprehensive review of clinical trials and research and really quality of life issues. Thank you so much. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker before we take questions is Richard Dickens, and Rick is an oncology social worker, and he is program coordinator of blood cancers, and he's project coordinator of mind-body program at Cancer Care. And he's going to present to you an overview of some of the cancer care services. Rick?
Hello. Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Vose and O'Connor. Your knowledge and delivery are very easy to understand, so it's always a pleasure to hear you. Thank you. As Cancer Care's program coordinator for blood cancers, I'm going to talk about cancer care services and how they might help you to best communicate with your healthcare team, building on some of what Dr. Vose and Dr. O'Connor have already said. Most people don't realize their oncology care is handled by a healthcare team, which includes their doctor, an oncology nurse and social worker, and often a physical therapist, chaplain, and other specialists. While each member of this team specializes in a certain area, they are all working together to coordinate your care. Since they operate in a team, the nurse and social worker are aware of your treatment plan and can offer expert advice or guide you to someone who can when your doctor is not available. For patients and families, there are numerous issues related to treatment which will impact your lives, such as concerns about insurance, workplace issues or treatment side effects and their possible impact on normal activities of daily living. These and other questions are common concerns and can create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. The good news is that at some point the whole process will become familiar to you and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many people I talk to, it's helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. Here are some quick tips to guide you. Do your research. The Internet is a good place to start, but there are many helpful organizations, such as Cancer Care, that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Take your time. Sometimes saying, "I need a day to think about this," can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get valuable feedback from loved ones and other respected resources. And speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. We provide information on resources and other strategies for finding help. We assist those most needy with financial grants and offer counseling interventions with oncology social workers for anyone with questions or concerns. We run regional face-to-face groups and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones, which provide emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. And we archive these telephone education workshops on podcasts on our webpage so people can access them more easily and as often as needed. To many, support groups, education, resources go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help from organizations like Cancer Care, they are never impossible. To reach us, you can go to 1-800-813-HOPE or online at www.cancercare.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for an excellent presentation about all the different services that people can access from Cancer Care and all those free services. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board and Ashley to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and then we'll start taking as many of your questions as we can. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Helen.
My question is probably for the first doctor, and thank you very much. It's been very informative. Having for years indolent small B in my bone marrow, cell lymphoma in my bone marrow with a high IgA of probably around 4,000, I've been lucky and have had never any treatment. However, in the last few years, I have neuropathy in my feet that has increased. And the neurologist had given me a drug, amitriptyline, probably improved about 20%. They can't
And your
really
question, Helen?
My question is,
yes.
How does one deal with the neuropathy given what I've told you?
Okay, thank you for that question. Dr. O'Connor, if you could address this in a general way.
So as I tried to allude to earlier, there's a lot of different variants of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and so there may be some detail here that I don't have in terms of your discrete pathologic diagnosis, but it sounds to me like it's a marginal zone lymphoma. And working off that presumption, many forms of lymphoma, it's actually a continuum of B-cell development. At one end of the spectrum, you have these very early kinds of cells that can give rise to leukemia, and at the very extreme, well-differentiated end, these very mature diseases like myeloma. And most B-cells are genetically programmed to secrete antibodies, which you need to play a role in fighting various infections. And, of course, then, when one of those professional B-cells become broken and malignant, their natural biological propensity to secrete antibody now just becomes revved up to very high degrees. And then these cells or these clones begin to build up in both number, and then the consequences of that would be the accumulation of protein in your blood, or in this case, a specific antibody secreted by that cell. Now, this requires a pretty detailed conversation with your physician, but if you had a symptom related to the disease, some people might interpret that as one reason for possible treatment. And if, in fact, the accumulation of protein in your blood as a consequence of the B-cell lymphoma is in fact true and related, then that would be a reason. There may be other reasons for neuropathy that may not be related to the lymphoma, and this is where you need to have a good, as Dr. Vose mentioned, well communicating team, and as Rick also mentioned, team of docs, so your neurologist talking to your oncologist talking to your neurologist, and then trying to sort out what people believe is the nature of the cause and effect relationship between your lymphoma and that neuropathy. And if it's concluded at the end of the day that the two are probably related, and maybe it's not so easy to conclude that they're related, but if there's a suspicion that they are related, then you may need to enter a dialogue with your physicians regarding whether that would meet one of the criteria for treatment.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Excellent. Thank you for that question, Helen. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Elaine.
Dr. O'Connor, does everyone with marginal zone NHL have H. pylori in their systems, and if so, should it be treated? I just learned of the connection.
So you raise another great question, which would require Dr. Vose and I another hour teleconference, and that is the relationship between infection and lymphoma. We know that increasingly infections do play a role as a cause of many kinds of lymphoma, and maybe some of the best documented relationships are between Helicobacter pylori and gastric malt lymphoma. But as you may or may not know, extranodal marginal zone lymphoma, so marginal zone lymphoma itself comes in three flavors, a version that grows in the spleen, a version that grows in lymph nodes, and a version that grows in extra lymph node sites like the stomach. So we do know that there are marginal zones that grow in the skin, in the eye, and in the lung, and that there are discrete infections that can be related to the cause of those particular lymphomas. But the good news is that actually treating the infection may make the lymphoma go away, and that's the case with Helicobacter pylori-related gastric malt lymphomas. So, the short answer to your question is no, not all malt lymphomas are related to H. pylori, but gastric malt lymphomas, not all of those are related to H. pylori. We do know the genetic differences between those gastric malt lymphomas related to H. pylori and not. And we can now even decipher the genetic differences between those gastric malt lymphomas responsive to antibiotics that are due to H. pylori and those that aren't. So gastric malt lymphomas tend to be the kind of lymphoma related to H. pylori, usually lymphomas in other part of the body that's not responsible for. And in those cases, treatment of the infection with the appropriate antibiotic regimen could actually cause regression of the lymphoma in the majority of cases.
Excellent. These are excellent questions. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Christine. Ma'am, your line is open.
Oh, thank you. I can't tolerate a lot of the drugs that have been administered, several in CHOP and so on. But one of the protocols, which is attached about anything anymore, is Rituxan, and I can't tolerate that either. Are there any products on the market in development that would replace that?
Thank you very much for that question. Dr. Vose, could you address that question in a general way in terms of the difficulty sometimes in tolerating drugs?
Sure. And every person, every patient is different with respect to what they can tolerate and what the side effects of the medicines are. And so that's why we often have to try different medications in different patients. And, of course, different medications may be appropriate for different patients as far as their disease. So without really knowing the information, I can't say what medication would be appropriate. But a lot of the newer medications we are currently working on are ones that specifically attack the lymphoma and don't cause so many side effects to the normal tissues and cells, so they're more lymphoma-specific. And I think that we'll find over the next few years as we find activity of these new medications that a lot of the side effects that we're seeing with some of these more general agents will be lessened and hopefully be able to be tolerated much better by patients.
So a good discussion with the healthcare team or with
the
physician.
Definitely need to speak with your physician about that.
And please take the information you've learned today to your physician, so hopefully you have more information to share in that discussion. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Pilun D.
Hi. My question is, can anyone comment about the follow-up course after the patient is gone on remission? What's the standard care on the PET scan? How often should be doing it instead of just following the symptom only?
That's a great question. Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Vos, would you each like to comment on that one in terms of, you know, that's a really great question.
Sure. Ladies first, Dr.
Vos. Okay. All right. Actually, there's a little bit of controversy about this, but the standard of care guidelines actually say that PET scan should be done for specific types of lymphomas, for the more aggressive lymphomas, for diffuse large B-cell, and for Hodgkin's disease. They are sometimes useful for other types of lymphomas, but not always useful. So a baseline PET scan before treatment is helpful to find out whether doing them afterwards is helpful at all. So typically we do a PET scan before treatment with most patients, and some of the more slow-growing types of lymphomas, PET scans are not very helpful. If they are helpful, then we typically would repeat the PET scan after the therapy is done. However, it's not recommended in the standard guidelines that PET scans be performed after that time for surveillance. They are not helpful, and in general, they're very, very costly. CT scans are generally, again, performed at the start of treatment, sometimes in the middle of treatment, and then at the end of treatment. And it's somewhat controversial whether CT scans are helpful in finding relapse sooner than one might see just on exams or blood work or symptoms the person has. So centers sometimes would do CT scans on a regular basis after that. And again, depending on the type of lymphoma, this may or may not be helpful in detecting relapses earlier. So it really has to be a little bit individualized in your particular situation. I'll let Dr. O'Connor comment from his end.
So I agree with everything. The only comment I might make is that patients sometimes have the perception that more tests are better because they feel like they're being scrutinized in a much better way. But that's not always the case. And, you know, no test that we get in medicine is absolutely perfect, right? No test is 100% perfect at finding something or 100% perfect at not finding it. And sometimes one of the conundrums that can be created with excessive testing, like PET scans, for example, in the wrong setting, is that it sees things that are just going to be what we call false positives. So it's not really lymphoma, but maybe you have a small infection in your lung, or maybe there's a small infection or inflammation in another part of the body. And what tends to happen then is it prompts all sorts of new testing, which prompts all sorts of new anxiety. And it's a careful balance between trying to use all of these technologies in a way that's going to really help you achieve the kind of treatment goals that you're looking for versus, you know, creating lots of unnecessary anxiety and expense and procedures that may not be warranted. And so that's why, as Rick and Julie both mentioned, this dialogue with your healthcare team is really, really critical, because it's not always the case that more use of these high technology tools is always to your best advantage.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Our next question, please. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Miriam.
I'm here. I had a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I was diagnosed in year 2000, and 2 years later I had a relapse. I was treated with CHOP, and 2 years later I had a relapse, and I was treated with Rituxan for 6 years, and everything seemed to be fine, and I've been in remission. This is now 2009, so I've been in complete remission with no treatment for the last two years.
And Miriam, your question?
The question is, recently I have been had some white foamy stuff in my urine, and the doctor said I was losing protein in my urine. And I was wondering, since I heard previously on this program that there's protein in the B cell and in the lymphocytes, I was wondering if that is a symptom of a reoccurrence of the lymphoma.
That's an excellent question. Thank you very much. And we are going to probably ultimately direct you back to your treating healthcare team with that question, but this is a good place to always try out your question. So, Dr. O'Connor, do you want to address that?
Sure. So the kidneys, as you know, play an important role in filtering various noxious byproducts of your metabolism from the blood. And the kidneys can be affected by both lymphoma and the treatment for lymphoma. Rituxan is not exactly known to be very toxic towards your kidneys, so I don't think that that's the necessary cause of anything. We do know that many lymphomas can affect the kidneys, A, by directly growing in or on the kidney. That tends to be somewhat unusual, but it's also unusual that kidneys can have these, lymphomas can have these other remote effects on the kidneys. We call them glomerular nephropathies, and there's a whole list of different kidney disorders that can be associated with various lymphomas, not because the lymphoma is growing in the kidney, but because of other remote effects of the lymphoma. So I think, as Carolyn mentioned earlier, this is an incredibly complicated area and one that probably requires you to have a detailed discussion with your oncologist, who may choose to get a nephrologist, a kidney specialist involved, because diagnosing these problems requires some very, very specialized perspectives and tests to get to the bottom of it.
Thank you for the question, Miriam. And so you will go back to your treating oncologist and talk with your oncologist about your concerns and come up with a solution for yourself. So thank you very much for the question. And I hope that the information you got today will help you when you speak with your physician to have a more informed discussion from your end. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Francis.
There's a Francis Kay on the line. My question, my father has passed, but he had a diagnosis of Waldenstrom's, and he's been dead since 2009. Rituxan had just come out. Along with the high IgM, he had manifested a rash on his skin, which was not diagnosable. Wondering if it was related to the disease itself. It was very itchy and made him miserable despite all kinds of treatments. Or could that have been due to Rituxan therapy at all? That was actually the only treatment he was given. And also, is there an infection connection to Waldenstrom suspected, specifically tuberculosis? I was wondering. His parents had passed away when he was 5 of that disease. He was exposed but not actively diagnosed. Thank you.
Excellent questions, Francis. I'm going to ask Dr. Vos to just address this in a general way, and then we hope that that will help you as you try to figure things out.
Sure. Waldenstrom's is a very rare type of a lymphoma that is typically slow-growing and also is associated with some of these high protein levels that we discussed earlier. Patients with various different types of lymphomas can have skin involvement with respect to the lymphoma itself, so I'm assuming that they may have biopsied that to rule that out. But for many patients that have a rash that continues, if they do have a diagnosis of lymphoma, we often do a skin biopsy to see if that is associated with the lymphoma directly or if it's associated with some of the side effects of the medication. Rituximab itself does not typically cause a rash, but in a rare occasion it can cause a skin rash or irritation. And unfortunately, some of our different treatments and medications do that we have that. But in a general way, there's typically no association between the Waldenstrom's and a rash other than those two issues. There is no association of tuberculosis with Waldenstrom's, and there are some patients with the more indolent or slow-growing type of lymphoma that have an association with hepatitis C, but that is something that is also, again, typically we test in patients with lymphoma or the hepatitis antigens.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Kim.
Oh, hello. Do you hear me?
Yes, Kim.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you. So, my father passed away just a few months ago, and the course of his illness was he had Waldenstrom's at the very beginning, and then it seemed that he had chronic lymphocytic leukemia. He was diagnosed with that, first acute and then chronic. And then there was a transformation which occurred just a couple years ago to either non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or small lymphocytic the small cell lymphoma. They weren't quite sure. And then at the end, it almost seemed as if he had characteristics of both leukemia and lymphoma.
And can your question?
Yeah, it was lymphoma, though. But my question is that a typical or a rare course, you know, to start with Waldenstrom's and end up, like, with leukemia and then lymphoma again and you know, like...
Good question. Dr. O'Connor, can you address that?
Sure. The devil is in the detail here, and oftentimes, by definition, when there are malignant cells circulating in the blood, we refer to that as a leukemic phase of the disease. So many forms of quote-unquote lymphoma, which really are almost strictly referring to malignancies of lymphocytes, when they grow when they circulate in the blood, in addition to having disease in lymph nodes, it would just be referred to as a leukemic phase. It's possible that you can have things known as composite lymphoma, where you have more than one specific subtype of lymphoma. Transformation, as you alluded to, would be one of these indolent diseases, which can happen with any form of indolent lymphoma, transforming from an indolent slow-growing disease to an aggressive one. So all of these things are features of various kinds of lymphomas. It sounds like your dad had some combination of these things. And, again, it would be, to really get a handle on the situation, useful to talk to the pathologist to see exactly what kind of disease each of those different problems he had was, in terms of the disease in the marrow, the disease in the blood, and the transformed disease. But, yes, these are all features that we recognize commonly in some patients with these diseases. They do represent challenging treatment cases, because it's not always obvious what the right treatment is. You typically treat the more aggressive disease. But in the absence of knowing the specific details, it's hard to make very specific comments. But it seems like the features of your dad's case are not uncommon in some patients with these diseases.
So it's an excellent recommendation. So, Kim, that you might want to speak to your dad's pathologist, his physician, to get a clearer picture for yourself, just so that you, in trying to figure all this out, have that information and be helpful to you. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've just been wonderful, wonderful speakers today, just extraordinary speakers, actually. And I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such great questions. We know that you ask the questions to actually get some, you know, help for your own questions, but in actually asking your question, you actually end up helping everybody on the call, because it allows our speakers to elaborate on the points that you've raised, and that ends up helping everybody. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening, and I know that everyone didn't get to ask your question, so if you didn't get to ask your question, please do call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Most importantly, I want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program, and that we recognize in planning a program like this that you all have many needs that really go far beyond a one-hour program. So in thinking about a program like this, we want you to know that we have lots of services at Cancer Care that do continue after this program ends. And so I would not want any one of you to feel that you are alone in coping with lymphoma, with any of the issues that you have brought up on the call today, or issues that, you know, that you're struggling with. I want you to now feel you're part of a community of support, and that you can access our staff here. We have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers. And we are here to provide practical and financial assistance, as well as all types of supportive counseling services, both one-on-one on the telephone, online. We also do all sorts of support groups, both on the telephone and online, lots of different support groups to help you. And we do also have bereavement support groups as well, so that we have groups for everybody on the call today. And those might be, for some of you, might find those helpful, and some of you might prefer to just talk to someone individually, or even just to know that we're here as a resource to you. You're now part of a community of support, and please do take advantage of that. We are here, and we are really intend to be with you every step of the way as you call us as you need to for different things that you might need. Now, I want to thank you all for participating today. I also do want to remind all of you that we do have a number of programs coming up in the near future, and we actually have a program coming up on peripheral neuropathy, since we did talk about that today on the program. And so just to stay tuned, many of you in your materials did receive a calendar of all of our upcoming programs. And in that calendar, you have the date for that program. And I definitely would recommend that you all, that if those of you who have concerns, about peripheral neuropathy would want to listen to our program on that on July 16th, and that's a great program, and I think you'll get a lot of information from that as well. So, again, I want to thank you all for participating today. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.